Welcome to the Nordic Leaders Podcast. Why is everyone talking about the Nordics? Could it be that that's where the happiest people live? The most innovative people? The fairest societies? The most free press? Or could it just be there's a lot of reindeer? Let's find out what's the real secret behind the Nordics. In the Nordic Leaders Podcast, we explore the secrets of the Nordic area through conversations that matter with leaders across the region. And also we invite commentators from the rest of the world to analyse the characteristics of leadership and being Nordic. Today we're delighted to welcome Alf Rehn, Professor of Innovation, Design and Management at the University of Southern Denmark. Welcome, Alf.
Pleasure to be here.
Thank you. And we have done our homework, and my homework was to read LinkedIn. So that was extensive. And what it said is that your specialities are innovation, creativity, trends, future thinking, strategy, leadership, gin. What could you tell us that is a speciality of yours that I can't find on LinkedIn?
The good thing about doing work in creativity and innovation, and a little bit kind of leadership kind of comes in there, you can basically just then deploy that in any field and sound at least semi-sensible. So since a lot of what I've done has been about questioning the assumptions that exist in certain fields and showing how a creative mindset or utilizing innovation can be both break those frameworks and contribute to those frameworks. So I've been put in front of fashion people and say, hey, can you talk about the future of fashion? We all know you need to be creative, but just how creative are you really? And then you throw out some things about creativity that they might not have thought about. They are often when you throw out stuff about technology, they often get a little, ooh, no, that sounds difficult. So I've gotten into this weird position where I can ply my trade, which is technically creativity and with an innovation tinge, but can ply that in many organizations. So I've talked to butchers and I've talked to cleaning ladies, literally, and CEOs and been invited in front of kings and presidents, weird kind of audiences, all of them, and done, if not the exact same shtick, then in a sense, variation of the shtick of what does it really mean to think? And what does it really mean to think the new? And how come, even though we all love the new and love the creative, traditionalism catches up with us all? We can all get trapped in our own biases.
How have you managed to keep up your own thinking environment over the last 12 months?
I have to say that I continuously struggle with the fact of, am I creative enough? And because after a while, of course, when you've become at least conversant in creativity theory, the one thing you start to notice in yourself are, of course, all your biases and all your limitations and just how little you've achieved and stuff like that. It can be quite depressing in its own way. I've kept up pretty much the same thing I do continuously. My main kind of, when people ask, what's your creativity trick? I say, I don't have a trick. I just read a shit ton. So every morning I open up my trusty iPad and my RSS feed reader and kind of open the tsunami of news, scan hundreds of news stories, most of which I've been immediately, but made sure that my input feeds are such that I get a lot of really weird stuff thrown at me. And some of those threads follow, others I just tweet narkily about, and others again I read and go, well, that was interesting, and somehow file it in the back of my mind and think, one day reading about this weird Kazakhstani filmmaker might come in handy. Surprisingly, sometimes it does. The thing people tend to hate about me, there are many, but the thing that even my closest kind of colleagues and including partner tends to hate about me is I have been blessed with a decent memory. I don't have a memory for things one should have a memory for. So I sometimes mix up the names of my own children, which is never a good look. I always remember the name of my partner, as proven by the fact that I'm with you here today. But I have a weird memory and exceptionally good memory for truly weird, bizarre little tidbits I've read only once. So quite often I've been standing on a stage and I'm talking about the emergence of technological trends, and all of a sudden, bing! I remember something weird I read months ago about, as you remember, I guess, the first pinball machine was created by, and then I start giving this kind of bit about the pinball machine. Never memorized this. I just happen to remember it. It is lodged there and somehow pops up at the right moment.
Is there something wacky that you've been reading today or this week that you can share with us?
My personal favorite wackiness, and I do love, if you really want to find a treasure trove of wackiness, follow what design schools, I'm at an engineering school, so we're slightly different, but what design schools do for their graduation projects. So I just read about this young woman of Asian descent at the design school in Eindhoven, who seemingly had been given some harsh criticism by her supervisor and immediately gone about to design what she called her tear gun. It is a contraption that captures her literal tears, freezes them, and turns them into bullets she could shoot at the person who made her cry. Now, the things that are captured in that, the notion of turning tears into bullets is a very poetic one, but also we remember, if you read our detective fiction, that being shot with an ice bullet is an actual thing in some detective stories. And also it's a kind of commentary on hurting people, as in emotional pain can be just as bad as physical pain. And of course, it's also a kind of commentary on gender, because it's a young woman, male supervisor made her cry. It's those kinds of things that I often trawl for input or little play-ins, also in speaking and even in consulting.
Since we were talking about wackiness, I was interested in the story about the butcher, the cleaning lady, and the CEO. Was that the same person?
No. Sorry. Those were three different audiences. Okay. For some reason, I've spoken to quite a lot of associations, and there are more associations out there than you'd believe. So it would be the butchers were an association for people in the meat industry. So a lot of people say very interesting things about regulations in the meat industry, for instance. I did not know, but even the butchers claim that their specific industry is the most regulated one in the world. I find it hysterical to find that almost every profession, including podcasters, find that their profession is the most kind of hindered by regulation.
I think we really don't follow any regulation here, do we?
Some of us. Did you help the butchers find some innovative ways to slaughter?
No.
They're all vegetarians, then.
It's funny you should say that. There is, of course, always this kind of play you can do in that you start talking to people about, so what they're doing, will that be completely taken away by an alternative? For obviously the cleaning ladies who talk a lot about what happens when robots can clean better than you can. For podcasters, you'd be, what happens when an artificial intelligence asks smarter questions than you do? And for the butchers, yes, I mentioned what happens if veganism takes off and what happens if we can start producing better steaks than you can carve in the lab, which we are not that far away from. I was a little afraid to do that to the butchers because they have knives and know how to use them. But they were surprisingly sympathetic. And I even talked to one, which I thought was odd, who came up afterwards and said, yeah, it's really interesting. And particularly for me, I am a master butcher, but I recently became a vegetarian. And then you go, are you allowed to be that?
Traitor.
But yeah, you meet the weirdest people at conferences.
That's amazing. Alf, you said the thing that people hate about you is you having a good memory. What else do people hate about you?
The hatred of my memory tends to be people who wish it they have had it. Then I do enjoy often pushing people's buttons. And I sometimes do, my mouth gets ahead of my mind at times. So I have said a fair few provocative things where people sometimes take me slightly too seriously, in which I mainly have tried to raise an issue or provoke a point, and then people believe that I hate everyone who is of a certain persuasion. I used to be more hated because I used to be much more kind of, let's call Alf and have him say something provocative. But after I gently asked some journalists that I don't necessarily always want to be the person telling everyone else to fuck off, I've toned down my personal profile. But when there was time when I had, let's just say I've gotten death threats. That's tapered off, thankfully. But some things I've said in media have been not well received.
So, Alf, you said you like to throw some provocative questions out there. What's the provocative questions that you would like to ask Stefano and Nick? Let's provoke them a little bit.
I already did that in a bit with what happens when artificial intelligences start asking smarter questions than they can.
The thing is, we are trying to play the opposite game. We are trying to be the most idiot that you can find on the planet. And that is hard, trust me.
Interestingly enough, I believe it was an old Neal Stephenson science fiction novel that somewhere in there, I can't remember exactly where, there was just this little tidbit that stuck with me. And that was the notion that, yes, at one point, artificial intelligence has got so good at solving complex passwords that nowadays everyone has passwords like cat or dog or password simply because AIs cannot believe that anyone would use that, something that stupid.
I'm ahead of my time.
And I love that because there is, of course, always the alternate path. There is always the second path. And I since I spend a lot of my time thinking about what does it mean to be a contrarian in an age where everyone tries to be a contrarian, or what does it mean to be non-creative in a field that calls itself a creative business, these kinds of paradoxes and contradictions are very near to my heart. I'm writing this thing about contrarians, for instance, that the funny thing is when you do what I do, particularly when we could still travel and meet each other, I would often talk about people with really extreme forms of thinking, people who are actually far rarer than you think. And then people always would come up to me afterwards and say, thank you for that. And you really describe how I am, because I'm the crazy guy at this company. And the first times I was complete because I was naive and stupid. You go, oh, man of my, wonderful. Can I interview you? Later on, you learned that this is probably a dolt because real contrarians don't think they're contrarians or crazy or anything. Real contrarians don't care to even listen to keynotes and absolutely do not care what is said during a keynote. They're somewhere else doing something. So the people came up and said, oh, I'm the crazy guy. No, you're not. You're just a difficult person.
No, what I was wondering, is all this seeking the opposites or trying to find the contrarians that is in us, is that helping with innovation and creativity? And what is innovation in itself? Yeah.
The last bit, I almost don't want to open that Pandora's box because then we could be stuck here for hours on end. But I was actually talking to somebody else. I was lecturing on creativity, critical creativity studies on Monday. And I was trying to emphasize that the problem people don't often see is that in creative work, not necessarily creativity, but in creative work, there definitely are two parts. One's the part everyone looks at, the, oh, let's get a crazy idea. Let's try out something nobody's tried out before. The whole cliche-ridden, the notion of thinking outside the box and all that. What people don't think about is the fact that then there's the bloody hard work of making something of that idea, and that work is often not super creative. So I'm a big fan of art, and I've worked with a fair few artists, and I'm also advising now on a report on kind of art and innovation. And I always emphasize that when you go into an artist's atelier, what you see there is, of course, not pure creativity. Oh, every work of there is perfectly original and perfectly novel. No, you see a bloody ton of iterations, sketch after sketch of the same thing, trying to capture the right idea. And you see a lot of hard work going in there. Sometimes people painting something for a week and then tossing it aside because it didn't work out, and scraps littered everywhere. And I love that bit. I love that bit when you, like an author does, you get an idea and it's just this quirky little thing. And then you work like a bloody slave for, at times, months, sometimes years, to turn that into something actually good. But nobody talks about that bit of sitting there and slaving for hours, sweating if you're doing something more laborious, or getting back pain from writing. Back pain is often a critical part of innovation, but nobody mentions it.
I don't know if you ever read this On Writing from Stephen King, which is, and then he describes the work of a writer as the work of the archaeologist that really has to clean up the dust and really take the characters out of the paper. It's a beautiful way how he describes it.
It is, to me, one of, I would say, one of the five best books on writing ever written. And interestingly enough, I do enjoy a Stephen King novel, but he can be a bit flabby, as in overlong as an author. But in there, in On Writing, he actually was crystal clear and always to the point. I give that to most of my PhD students and say, read this, simply because I believe that the lessons he has in there are universally useful.
Yeah, it's a beautiful book.
Could we steer our attention just for a second to the Nordic area? How's Denmark? How's Denmark? Has it coloured your perception around leadership? Has it added to your thinking on this paradox?
I think every new context brings something novel and something new and something valuable. Denmark, even for somebody who's been married to a Dane, who has an 8-year-old Danish son, who's lived in the country off and on for quite a long time now, basically a decade, I still find Denmark difficult to wrap my head around. It is a difficult country. In part, Denmark is fairly similar to Finland. There are more similarities than people would think. One, of course, is the joint hatred of Swedes, which helps in communication.
Dane and a Finn and a Norwegian together, they just spend the whole time telling Swedish jokes.
Absolutely, they do. But then there's also other things. So Danes have a similar, not an identical, but similar sense of humor to the Finns. So Danes, they do have a sort of self-depreciating humor, and they also have very black humor, dark humor, which is interesting. Then there are the actually fairly massive differences. I kid around about the fact that Danes are often portrayed as these very cuddly figures. We speak of hygge, we talk of long leisurely lunches, and everyone walking down Strøget with a beer in their hand. There is this mythology. Danes are actually quite difficult to get close to. Danes have a very distinct kind of idea about who to socialize with. For instance, Danes do not make friends at the office. In Finland, most people's friends are made at the office. Some of them only have friends at the office. In Denmark...
Well, that happens because they don't meet each other otherwise.
There is that.
The only place where they can meet each other is the office.
There is that. But for the Danes, the office is the office and work is work and playtime is playtime and never the twain shall meet. So that surprised quite a lot of people when they come here. And also, there is this transition when you have a social connection to a Dane. I, for instance, had my ex-father-in-law, charming guy. We still are somewhat in touch and congratulate each other on birthdays and stuff because I didn't have a very acrimonious divorce from his daughter. And because at first he's very attentive to me when I'm introduced to the family. And then one day he basically turns over to me and goes, "Oi, shithead, can you go and get some cucumber? We're out." And walks off. And I'm kind of, did I insult him? What now? And I actually asked my then wife, "I'm sorry, your dad basically just cursed me out and sends me on errands." And she looks at me and goes, "Oh yeah, he likes you." I said, "What?" I said, "No, but you're one of the family now. We're not going to treat you particularly nicely because you're one of the family. This is how we treat family." So I realized that when I got cursed out by people, even at the office, I was, you shut up. Then, okay, we're friends. Which a lot of the other kind of non-Nordics can find very difficult to parse. I'm being cursed at, is this friendliness? So that kind of transition is difficult. And the third thing, which I think is important if you're in business, and since all of us are one way connected to business, Danish leadership is far more direct than Finnish's. For me, the main mythology in Finland has been the one you may know of the Finnish saying, reilu meininki, good. We talk straight. We say it like it is. We can just go about our business, blah, blah, blah. And I go, bloody hell, don't lie to yourselves. The Finns are a very proper and very polite and somewhat circumspect people who have this mythology of them being direct. Danish bosses will chew you out and not think twice about it. And Danish negotiators will actively try to screw you out of as much money with not a hint of guilt connected to this. And I love it because I found working in Finnish corporations sometimes a little difficult because there was this macho mythology going on at the same time. I was going, if one of you could speak straight, just one, and instead of having this notion that you are these hard-talking, hard-drinking folks. In Denmark, a lot of the time in the corporate life, they are as Finns think they are, which is an interesting kind of thing to observe.
Nick, you're looking very quiet up there. What are you thinking up there?
I'm just thinking about a previous life in London when I was managing a Nordic team, and I remember the Danes. The Danes in particular, particularly the trading floor at Danske Bank in Copenhagen, I had to go and visit from time to time and speak to our customers. And I felt that the Danes were a little bit like the French of the North. They wanted service in Danish, whereas Sweden, Norway, Finland were okay with English. So I felt they were really quite demanding, quite ruthless, quite direct, and they wanted service in Danish that we were delivering from London. So we had to go and recruit some really good Danish speakers. So yeah, that was just a reflection of what Alf was saying there. So I think I agree with what he's saying. And Denmark to me seems like a quite confident, compact country. They seem really confident. They've got their design and stuff. Alf.
There is a lot of confidence. And also these days I get along fine here because my Danish is now good enough that people can hear that I'm actually not just learned from some kind of Duolingo course or something like that. I actually can curse out people in Danish and I can tell rude jokes in Danish and often try to do. So I'm getting treated as a Dane. But I used to joke around about the fact that I'm a Swedish-speaking Finn, or actually bilingual Swedish-Finnish, which meant that when I spoke earlier in Danish, it sounded like a Swede to most Danes. And obviously that meant that I got, well, I don't want to call it racist, because racism implies a different kind of power dynamic. But there is a certain xenophobia, or at least a conviction that Danes already know how things should be, and don't you come here telling us how to run our country. So there is that. And I can recognize the confidence. Not least, I love the fact that Danes are so incredibly confident in English, and that has no relationship to whether they actually know the language or not. So I've had some howlers. So for instance, there was this time when our dean was writing up a strategy document, and we were shown the strategy document at the workshop for heads of units. And I said, yeah, just kind of think, maybe we shouldn't write that we will want to be the consorts of industry, because the consort does have a slightly different tinge. And he was, no, it's a perfectly fine word. If you actually look it up, it means royal mistress. You're telling us we should be the horse of industry. And he looks it up in the Oxford English Dictionary and goes, yes, we shall find a new word. But it had to be pushed to that. And it is confidence. My students sometimes pure gibberish in English, and there is no kind of... They write very confidently, very quickly, and they get very surprised every time I correct them. So I do recognize the confidence.
What's the Danish for strawberries and cream?
That would be jordbær med fløte, but you're actually wanting to ask me what is red porridge with cream, which is a porridge where you've used red berries to, and that's with cream, and that's rørgrød med fløte.
Fantastic. You passed the test.
But I've got a business idea while we've been doing this. My idea is a Duolingo type app that is all the stuff that you can't learn on Duolingo, all the swearing and all of the funny phrases. And
shit, go and get a cucumber.
Exactly. Yeah. There probably is such an app already. But
I think that's a premium hidden level on Duolingo. At least if they're smart, there definitely is an attachment pack.
Yeah, the Platinum Club. Social media. Alf, we love our guests talk about social media. What's your relationship with social media?
I would say tapering off, if that's allowed to say. I was super into social media at one point. I loved Twitter when it came out and was really enthusiastic about it. LinkedIn, maybe not quite so much, but I enjoyed mucking about with it. I was really taken by the potential of social media and so on. And I've had stuff go moderately viral on Facebook, and at times I've had a comment of mine discussed in Finnish government, or in Finnish parliament, not in a very negative manner, but still discussed in Finnish parliament. Alf Ren writes something in Facebook and it becomes headline news. I have tapered off on social media. I believe that it's difficult these days to really... It seems so much work for so little payoff. I do still post stuff and I try to keep up. But these days, you really need to make the decision, which of them will I be on? Because I remember, so you put certain things on LinkedIn, kind of jokey stuff on Facebook and serious stuff on Twitter. And that was it. And now you should curate your Instagram feed. Seemingly my grid is not quite good enough. You should be on Clubhouse chit-chatting all the time, whilst, of course, putting kind of a lot of tweets lined up in your social media manager. It gets all a bit much. And I think I have... My struggle is I can't decide which one to be on. Should I close down everything else and just be full on Twitter? Or should I get into... Seemingly now the thing one should become is a Clubhouse influencer. Literal article I read this morning about the race to become the Clubhouse influencer. And frankly, I find Clubhouse quite tedious. I tried to get into it. I got an early invite, but this is like bad radio. This is like a podcast that never ends.
Yeah, I'm with you on that. I don't want to be a Clubhouse member of a Clubhouse that would have me as a member. So that's...
No, me neither. Me neither, David.
Okay, so I have a question that I promised my daughter that I would ask, which is, if you were reincarnated as a gin botanical...
Well, then clearly I would become a juniper berry. Toxic in high doses, often too bitter to deal with, but when submerged into alcohol, sometimes curiously interesting.
If you were the podcast host, what would you ask Professor Alf Ren?
I get this question in various forms quite a lot.
Do you? Oh, shit.
Yeah, okay. I do. I think it's because, and I recently wrote a book chapter about this, I think it's because people somehow pick up on the fact that my life is in this weird kind of identity play. So on one hand, there is Professor Alf Ren, this kind of media character who gets attention and can sometimes even be on the cover of magazines. And then there is basically the academic Alf Ren, who is far less interesting in many ways, but the one who potters around at home. I think that what the questions I've most enjoyed have been around basically, how does one keep working in this bizarre liminal space when one part of your identity doesn't even know what the other part of the identity does? Or when you suddenly find yourself at a tender young age speaking to professors or even presidents and people actually listening and taking notes. And I have to say that my answer has always been, well, still confused, but on a higher level. So I don't know how I work or why the stuff I do works. I just notice that I get into lots of interesting scrapes and adventures. And as long as that works and I don't injure myself too much, I think I'm going to try and keep doing that. But I don't understand myself all the time either.
Scrapes and adventures. Who does that remind you of?
Well, I think I nicked that from the fantastic comedian James Acaster, who even had a book called James Acaster's Classic Scrapes. And I am a huge stand-up nerd, so stuff like that sticks.
But isn't that so that we all are, in a way or another, quite weird, and all of us have this kind of not reconcilable opposites? we look back and then we make a straight line of our careers and our life, because that's the author that is in us that tries to make a story out of that. But then in that moment, we had no idea what we were doing and we just did it.
I do not claim in the slightest way to be unique or special in any way whatsoever. I think that I am, though, in the strange place in which, as a professor and as a strategic advisor and as somebody who writes books and is supposedly, due to this, at least clever or an expert in something, I'm expected to have figured it out and have better answers than I do. And I just tend to say that, no, I'm just as confused as everyone else. I just have had the fortunes of making my confusion into something of a business model.
So the business model of confusion, that is, again, another startup idea, by the way.
So when you're teaching and you're working with those young students that you mentioned, what's the most common word they use to describe you when they give feedback?
I don't know. I try, and just like one should never read the comments in the comments section in newspaper, I try. I have somebody who comes and say, do you want to see your evaluations? And I go, do I have to? And they go, no, they're good enough. And then they walk away with them. I think most of my students actually like me, in the sense that I try still, because I know that the stuff I work with are often quite strange and often new to them. I'm the one who teaches gender theory to engineering students. That's not necessarily something they are immediately comfortable with. So I try very hard to do it in an understanding way and not overburden them or overtax them. I've never was really enjoying being the hard-ass teacher who goes my way or the highway. So I'm not necessarily a pushover in the business world, but I'm a bit of a pushover when teaching. I want students to make it. I want students to succeed. They will fail later in life, so there is no point in instilling that fear of them into them when I have them at a tender and impressionable age. So I think most of them think I'm pretty okay. Then what they say to their parents and their friends afterwards. And if there was one thing, I had a very difficult student not that long ago. And it was a struggle to get him to finish, and I had to be pretty hard with him, because some of my younger male students require a bit of a, I'm not saying father figure, but they require a bit more of the stick and a bit less of the carrot, because they've been force-fed carrots their entire lives. And we had a fairly, it wasn't the most pleasant of experiences. And then we passed him, and he actually came to me afterwards, and I thought, okay, this is it. This is where he tells me that I'm a fucking bastard, and he wants to fight me and all that. And he just comes and goes, I know we didn't really always get along, and you thought I was lazy and so on, but I just want to come and say thanks. You're okay after all. And I think you don't need better than that. I'm fine with being okay after all.
Yeah, that's great. There we have the episode title for today. He's okay after all.
He's okay. David, can I squeeze, if it's okay with Alf, if there's time, yeah, I just wanted to squeeze one more question in. It's just really interesting listening to Alf describing himself. And I just wonder, was there anyone in your childhood, when you were growing up, any similar Alfrein characters that you were following and looked up to?
No, I can quite honestly say no. My weird personality was very much crafted out of the fact that my father had a contrarian tendency. He was a good father, a very kind father. There was no threats or violence or anything like that. But he would, almost like clockwork, after 1.5 years, he would be in a fight with his bosses. He was a genius chemist, one of the, in certain areas, actually a top global expert, not an academic, but as in actual practical expert, often in very specialized chemicals, and which meant that we moved once every year or once every 2 years. So I moved school after a year or two constantly. And what does that mean? That means a couple of things. You need to learn to pick up social skills damn fast. You will get bullied. And you will have to accept that as a normal part of your life. And if you're me, you will become convinced that books are safer friends than humans, because books you can bring with you when the van leaves. So the ones I wouldn't say model myself after, but I realized at a later stage in life that I loved stories all about basically scrapes and adventures. I loved stories about gentlemen thieves like Arsène Lupin. I loved stories about the Crimson Pimpernel, the kind of shape-shifting, mask-wearing, clever clogs who kind of tricks everyone. Tricksters were always very close to my heart. And I guess that I, in my own very modest way, modeled myself a little bit after these tricksters who could be one thing in one medium and completely different in another.
Very interesting. Yeah, really interesting.
Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you. Thank you, Alf. Thank you.
Thanks, Alf. It was fun and insightful.
Real pleasure.
How would you rate your podcast guest experience today?
This has been fun. I always think it's more challenging when there are more than one interviewers, because one needs to talk to all three, both individually and as a group. And then there's, of course, the who's asking now and so on. But no, I think this went well.
Hey, listener. It's Stefano here. Since you got until here, we think that you might like the podcast. It would mean so much if you could leave us a 5-star review and share this with as many of your friends as possible. This will help us be discovered and spread the news. Can you just take 5 minutes and do that for us? Thank you.